This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ellen Schrecker is a scholar of the McCarthy era. She's drawn on newly released FBI files and private papers for her new book, Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America. She looks at the origins of the hunt for communists and its impact on American politics and culture. Her previous book, No Ivory Tower, examined McCarthyism and the universities. Schrecker is a professor of history at Yeshiva University and has also taught at Harvard and Princeton. I asked her first about her reaction to the new book by Harvey Clear, who just joined us. Clear concludes that the American Communist Party was funded and controlled by the Soviets. His book is based on newly released documents from Soviet archives.
Well, I think the new documents are extremely important. A number of historians besides Harvey Clear and his colleagues have been working in these archives and are finding really very valuable material about American communism, so that we do begin to flesh out a picture of an organization that I think to a certain extent was an appendage of the Soviet Union. But I think Harvey Clear's take on American communism is a little one-sided because it was also an American party. Yes, it slavishly followed the Soviet line with regard to a number of issues, especially international issues, that were crucial to the Russians. American communists did, to their shame, to their moral degradation, they did support the purges. At the same time, in the United States, with regard to American issues, they operated with a certain amount of independence, mainly because the Russians weren't necessarily that concerned with a local rent strike or a local organizing campaign in a union. So that you have this very complicated organization. And I think the interpretation in Harvey Clear's book is a little too flat, is a little too one-sided. It doesn't really grasp the reality of American communism.
Now, your book, Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, is based in part on new information from Soviet archives and from the Freedom of Information Act, FBI files, here in the United States. What's some of the new information that you have gotten access to for your book?
Well, I use the Freedom of Information Act in my research to get a look at FBI files. What I wanted to do, though, was different from what other historians have been doing up until now. I wanted to look at as many different kinds of files as I could, rather than concentrate on one or two cases, so that what I discovered was a wide range of FBI practices that gave me an understanding of how the FBI was really at the center of the McCarthy period. I used these files, many of them other people had gotten a hold of, to put together a case, a sort of overview of FBI practices, of the fact that the FBI was always tapping people's phones, was always using illegal methods, was very... What's interesting is the FBI was an investigative organization, and we sometimes forget that what it was investigating for was to put together prosecutions that could be used in criminal cases. So what one sees is the FBI criminalizing people's ordinary political practices, and that's what I found by using a large number of FBI files.
You say that had we known in the 1950s what we know now that the Freedom of Information Act files on the FBI have been opened, McCarthyism probably would have been called Hooverism.
That's right. J. Edgar Hoover was, if anybody, the mastermind of this anti-communist political repression of the late 1940s and 1950s. He had been obsessed with communism since the Russian Revolution and had really worked out the machinery that was erected during the McCarthy period that was so incredibly effective, that machinery of trying to identify people as communists and then of using sanctions against them, mainly economic sanctions. In other words, Hoover was very interested in having communists be fired from the government, certainly, but also from private industry, from local governments. And he had implemented, for example, a program in the early 50s called the quote-unquote responsibilities program, where he told governors and school superintendents what people to fire. So he was very much involved at the center. The other thing that he did was create the kinds of tests, political tests, that were being used to identify communists.
Like loyalty tests.
Not just loyalty tests, sort of reality tests. In other words, the Communist Party was secret. People did not go around with little badges saying, "Hi, I'm Ellen Schrecker. I'm a communist." And this was different from communism in Europe, say. The American Party thought it was going to be repressed, and so they wanted to keep, for reasons of protection, they wanted to keep their membership secret. So the main problem the FBI had was figuring out who was a member of the Communist Party. And what they did was they devised this notion of guilt by association. If somebody belonged to certain organizations, signed certain petitions, had certain kinds of books or subscribed to certain kinds of newspapers, if you put all of these facts together, you could then come up with a sort of profile that in the 1950s was sort of looked on as a duck test. If somebody walked like a duck, waddled like a duck, quacked like a duck, looked like a duck, then probably they were ducks. And the FBI sort of designed these duck tests, as it were. And then they were used by the House Un-American Activities Committee, by local school boards, by Hollywood blacklisters, as ways of identifying people as communists.
Now, when you say tests, were there any, for instance, government employees who literally had to take a test?
Not really tests. There were sort of loyalty questionnaires. The main thing that these quote-unquote political tests, and I do use the word figuratively, not literally, these political tests were trying to determine was people's views, so that if somebody was called up before a loyalty board, suspected of communist affiliations because they had signed certain petitions or belonged to certain organizations, they would often be asked their views on things like American foreign policy. Did you support the Marshall Plan in Western Europe? Did you support integration? There was a lot of racial stuff that came out during this period because the Communist Party supported integration very early on, so that in many instances, whites who had views in support of desegregation in the South could be sort of viewed as tainted in some way.
You say that, Hoover's main target in his war against communism was the trade unions. Why?
Hoover was interested in looking for communists in the trade unions because they were there, because the American Communist Party had focused most of its efforts in the 1930s and 1940s on unions, on organizing unions, and had, in fact, gotten a certain amount of influence in a number of important industrial unions in this country. So that when Hoover went after trade unions, he was doing it in part because he wasn't particularly sympathetic to them, but also because the communists were there.
How much influence do you think the communists actually had on American trade unions at the time?
The Communist Party contained people who were very active as union organizers, who had gotten in the early years of organizing in certain industries, and they did have control of about 20% of the unions that were part of the CIO. They couldn't make these unions sort of follow a Russian line. You know, they were essentially ordinary trade unionists. And to the extent that they imposed a quote-unquote communist agenda, it was a matter of running editorials in the union papers or having resolutions passed at the union conventions. But it didn't actually affect what they did in their day-to-day labor activities.
What techniques did Hoover use to infiltrate the trade unions?
What's very interesting, I've looked at a number of the FBI files for the unions. And Hoover had informers, of course. He also had bugs in the union offices. He tapped their phones illegally. He also subscribed to the union newspapers. I mean, there was a lot. We think of the FBI as being very devious and unconstitutional, but a lot of what Hoover and the FBI did was go to meetings, get leaflets, read newspapers, and he had a pretty good idea of what the communist-led trade unions were doing. He tried as best he could, and he had a lot of support. There were a lot of anti-communists within the labor movement who wanted to get the communists out of the labor union. So Hoover was not the only person who was focused on eliminating communist influence within the labor movement.
My guest is Ellen Schrecker, author of the new book, Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ellen Schrecker, author of a new book about McCarthyism called Many Are the Crimes. Now, you describe Hoover and the FBI as creating the infrastructure in the war against communists in America. When does Joseph McCarthy actually come onto the scene, and how closely did he work with Hoover?
Well, McCarthy appeared in American history in the beginning of 1950, by which time that movement, McCarthyism, to which he gave his name, really had been underway for at least 3 years. And McCarthy is one of a number of figures who, in my book, I call an anti-communist network, a group of professionals who were really dedicated to eradicating all the influence of the Communist Party in this country. And these anti-communist professionals sort of flocked to McCarthy's side when it was very clear that this individual had a real sort of demagogic gift for getting media attention, getting a lot of publicity, making a big fuss, and hurting the Democratic Party. And so Hoover was feeding McCarthy information. A number of these sort of private anti-communist professionals were feeding him information, writing his speeches. And what I discovered in my book was that these people were all in contact with each other. And when they found McCarthy as their spokesperson, they sort of descended on him and just threw tons of material at him, which he then sort of funneled out into the public.
What are some of the new things you feel like you learned about McCarthy's role in McCarthyism in America?
Well, I think the main thing that I've discovered is that McCarthy was, as I said, really kind of amplifying the voices of these other people in the anti-communist network. McCarthy was able to amplify scenarios that had been worked out, especially the most important one, and it was one that was used by the Republican Party in the early 1950s, was that of the quote-unquote loss of China, that the notion that there had been communists in the State Department who had betrayed China to Mao Zedong. And McCarthy made that, in the beginning, the main target of his early allegations.
One of the things you do in your new book is look at the impact of the McCarthy purges on life in America. Give us an overview of what you think the biggest impact was.
The main impact of McCarthyism on the United States, I think, was the destruction of a kind of left perspective, the marginalization of a lot of interlinked ideas about class, the notion that that there were class divisions in this country seemed to be sort of shoved under the rug. You also saw, for example, within the civil rights movement, where the American left had been active in the 1940s. The civil rights movement by the 1950s becomes focused not on questions of economics and economic injustice, but much more narrowly on questions of eliminating the legal injustices of segregation in the South. You see a narrowing as well in terms of, say, the peace movement, that the whole notion of anti-nuclear disarmament, for example, because it was associated with American communism, is marginalized throughout much of the 50s.
In the 20 years that you've been studying communism and anti-communism in America, has your view of the Communist Party in America changed as a result of newer documents that have been released?
Yes, I think it has. To begin with, I guess I started with the assumptions that had been fairly common in the 1950s and 60s that McCarthyism was attacking, quote-unquote, innocent victims. And what I discovered was that most of the people who were affected by McCarthyism had been in one way or another involved with near the Communist Party, that in fact, although these people were unjustly persecuted, they were not incorrectly targeted.
So does the story become slightly less black and white to you now?
Exactly. The story of communism and anti-communism in this country is I like to view it almost as a kind of a cable, you know, like a suspension cable with many different strands in it. And what we're seeing here is an incredibly complicated movement, a movement that had both very positive elements in it, if you tend to believe that support for desegregation is positive, which I think it is, but it also had these elements of uncritical support for the Soviet Union, a certain amount of espionage. And it was a movement that sort of supported some of the best ideals in American life and also was dogmatic. It was undemocratic. It fostered a kind of unthinking acceptance of what the American communist and Soviet communist leadership believed in. So it's a very, very mixed picture. And to present it as black and white is incorrect. Also, I would add that to present McCarthyism as sort of black and white is equally incorrect. This is a movement that I think is very complicated, and many people joined it for many reasons, and we can't view them all as sort of, you know, evil. We can't demonize them just as we can't demonize the American communists.
What have you found that led you to that conclusion that the anti-communists can't just be demonized? Who have you found who had motives that you consider to be more idealistic and truly democratic?
Well, it's not so much a matter of idealism or democracy as sort of understanding how people could have embraced this sort of anti-communist consensus. Why people who today look back on the McCarthy period and say, oh, how could we have done this? And what I was really trying to do is figure out how they could have done it, how these very moderate, liberal, open-minded people could have bought into a movement that ultimately was pretty undemocratic. And I think it had to do with the sort of plausibility of the Soviet threat, the plausibility of this notion, this very demonized notion of what American communism was. Because what you have to realize was that communism was a secret movement. People didn't really understand it. And what you had was this anti-communist network of J. Edgar Hoover, of the staff members in HUAC, of ex-communist professional witnesses who had their own scenario and their own vision of what communism was and who were able to sell this vision to the rest of the country, to the American political elites, who then devised a program of anti-communism, of eliminating communists from labor unions, from movie studios, from universities, because they had a demonized and largely sort of black and white image of American communism that they felt needed to be eradicated from American society.
Well, Ellen Schrecker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Ellen Schrecker is the author of Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America. She's a professor at Yeshiva University.